kicking and still is there opposite me in the studio, but here's something she prepared earlier.
Sir Thomas Beecham was a major influence on British musical life. Orchestral entrepreneur, opera impresario, and fearless champion of little-known composers and music. His vision, to make Britain a musical nation. In a special evening on BBC Radio 3 this Bank Holiday Monday, I'll be drawing on a wealth of Beecham's recordings, hearing from the people who knew him and discussing his achievements as we pay tribute to a great music maker and coruscating wit who died 50 years ago. Join me, Susie Klein, for an evening with Sir Thomas Beecham tomorrow night from 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Olivia Williams is currently starring with Matthew Fox in Neil LaBute's psychological thriller In a Forest, Dark and Deep in London's West End. She began her career on the stage at Bristol Old Vic and then the RSC. She was Jane Fairfax in the British television film Emma, based on the Jane Austen novel. More recently, she played Austen herself in Miss Austen Regrets. Major film roles have included Rushmore and Education, The Postman, and the Sherry Blair character in The Ghost. I have a feeling that the arts and music might have been around you as a child.
Very much. I am indebted to my father and mother for surrounding me with literally surrounding me with music. All of my childhood, Radio 3 is on all the time. My father, in the days before having a speaker in every room, he literally just carried a radio. He would close the strap of it in the car door, in the window. He'd wind the window up, and he would have it in the garden at breakfast, you know, record review. And the fact that people still say compact discs is part of my childhood.
The first music, I think, takes us back to your childhood.
Yes. At school, I was asked as my first bit of music homework to find a piece of music and play it and write a review of it and bring it into school. And my mother had just been given the Bach cello suites by one of her pupils. She's a barrister. And I think it was actually the rather nice navy blue cover with a picture of a rather romantic looking bald man in glasses that attracted me to Pablo Casals' recording of the Bach cello suites. This piece of music has followed me around the world. I remember I was staying in a house in Los Angeles when I was very much on my own in Los Angeles, having made a couple of movies. And it was a house that had the sound system all around it. It wasn't more than quadraphonic, it was octophonic. And I put this on as loud as it could go, and I was in the Hollywood Hills overlooking Hollywood, and it seemed as appropriate to that place as it did to every other place I've ever played it. It's just universally applicably moving.
Thank you.
am I allowed to say orgasmic on Radio 3?
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Is that not that last 30 seconds?
And it's so interesting to say that about a solo Baroque instrument, because what normally we think of Tchaikovsky, Romeo and Juliet, or Tristan und Isolde, with those huge orchestral climaxes. But you're right, there's that kind of constant striving and then going over the edge.
And each successive rise is a slight, and then it sort of pulls back, and the slight... I'm sorry to talking in these terms, but I find it very, very moving, as I said.
There we heard the wonderful Pablo Casals playing the prelude from the cello suite in G by Bach. Now, I think you actually have a musical connection with the next piece, Olivia Williams.
Yes. What I love about my job is that things happen through extraordinary connections. And a woman from my antenatal classes, who's an Italian, rang me up one day and said, a friend of mine from Bologna would love you to record a story that he's written about a piece of music. And I always say yes in these situations. And she introduced me to Marco Mencoboni, who finds obscure pieces of unperformed choral music and his choir of extraordinary singers with an incredible range and of voices sings these in obscure churches around the world, but mostly in Italy. And he played this music to me and I loved it. And he'd written a story about the composer, Diego Ortiz, who is Spanish, but came to Italy. I love it because it's very dramatic. I try and avoid, you know, bringing in my job to everything, but I think that's why I love it. It's almost shouted. And I can imagine this being music on stage. It's very theatrical in its sort of urgency. But I've always loved church music. I've loved the most pure. I love the Allegri Miserere. I love a choir boy singing a single note. And this brings all that in, the drama and the church and the purity and the roughness.
Laudate Domino omnes
contrast between the Gregorian plain chant there and the sort of choruses. I mean, you almost had a kind of smoothness and then a deliberate kind of roughness and very much human, raucous sound.
Yes, and I think that's one of the reasons I love that, because it brings the purity that I grew up with. You know, in I went to Cambridge University, I was very lucky, and I loved going to Evensong and hearing those pure voices. But the sort of drama in my life, you know, the human body responds physically to a shout, and I can feel that when I hear there's one voice in there that has that rasping quality, and it actually makes my heart beat faster when I hear it. And so much of modern life is sort of in denial of that voice. I'm quite excited, actually, that I have that voice at the moment, because I'm working on stage and I sort of lost my voice. But to find that kind of gritty earthiness in us, it really sort of goes unexplored.
Laudate Dominum by the 16th century Spanish composer Diego Ortiz. That was Psalm 116 from the Vespers. And it was sung by Cantal Ontano, directed by Marco Mencoboni. Our next composer, Arvo Pärt, has that sacred quality, doesn't he, that you're interested in. I mean, what we're actually going to hear is instrumental, but I still think that some aspect of that kind of purity pervades his music. Would you agree about that with this piece?
Very much so. I believe this music correct me if I'm wrong, is related to mourning and remembering the Second World War, which was a period, again, it almost became pop culture in my generation. I think it's because we all learnt about it at O-level or A-level. And anything associated with that time, I went to school in North London. A large percentage of the school was Jewish, and I felt very connected to the sort of Jewish experience. Again, as I was growing up, I was introduced to it by an astonishing actress called Anastasia Hilly, and I understudied her, which is a very unfortunate way to begin a friendship, because really all I wanted her to do is break her ankle so I could play her part. But she was infuriatingly healthy, and for 4 months I toured around the United States understudying her astonishing performance as Lady Anne. And she used to play this piece of music in the dressing room to prepare for the unbelievable tragedies that Lady Anne has suffered at the hands of Richard.
And so it's almost a stimulus to tears.
It's not almost, it is a stimulus
to tears.
Do you
use things like that? I mean, if you've got to sort of weep on stage.
Absolutely. It's actually not on stage, because you have a run at it on stage. Usually just being in the situation makes you cry. Mm. The time I have to use music is when I'm on film, because you have to cry now and then you have to stop. And then you have to wait 20 minutes and now you cry again and now stop and now do it again and again and again. And you have to have a piece of music. I find if you start thinking about genuine tragedies in your life, the awful thing is after about the 20th take, it stops working. Hmm. And the saddest thing in your life no longer elicits emotion. So music is that for me. And this is one of them. that sound of a bell has all the ideas of a death and for whom the bell tolls. Again, it's dramatic to me. It you absolutely see and feel as a result of what you hear, which I love.
Interesting also that a bell plays a very significant role in one of his most famous pieces that I think we heard first in this country, which was the Cantus in Memory of Britain, where a simple descending scale repeated over and over again has a kind of mesmerising effect.
Yeah, so again, analysis of music like that came from my father all the time when I was young, and he observed that either a falling or a rising scale can be the thing that clinches it emotionally, something so simple, but you have to have the sophistication to manipulate it. I'm not very literate about more avant-garde music, but Arvo Pärt, as you say, he is my sort of route into it. He's my crossover composer.
Would you say there's an analogy with acting in that there are certain things that you can use that you know? I mean, you were saying how an upward scale is slightly uplifting and a downward one is all sad, usually. Is there that in acting? I mean, are there things that you know you can do that you resort to that will...
Oh, yes. Absolutely. It's been very interesting working with Matthew on stage because he's primarily a television actor. And while he has fantastic instincts about theatre, and thank God, because it could have been a disaster, there are moments of absolute courage you need, pausing, silence, waiting, which are decisions that are made for you as a film actor by the editor. But when you're a stage actor, it's the bravery of that last note of Tabula Rasa. You assume it's going to stop and it keeps going. And the fact it keeps going is its triumph. And it's the same with pausing, the bravery to pause and not bore people, but to enthrall them with silence. These are techniques that have been used since people started speaking.
I was very struck by an incredibly young and hugely enthusiastic audience. I mean, it must be very gratifying to find that you're filling the theatre with young people who are so enthusiastic.
It is. I've worked a lot at the National Theatre and the RSC, and I don't think either of those places would be offended, because it is the truth that their demographic is over 60. And what's extraordinary about being in the West End and working with Matthew Fox, who is primarily a television actor, is that you're bringing in people who haven't been to the theatre and they're loving it. You know, at moments that our esteemed critics thought were sort of hackneyed and corny, the audience gasps with amazement at what we're doing and the fact they're seeing it happen before their eyes. And it's immensely gratifying. You know, I've been around the track a few times. I've been working as an actor for 20 years, and to get such an instant response is really exciting.
Well, one should say, apropos of your voice and what you've been saying, that it is a two-hander, of course, and you are on stage the entire evening without a break.
Yes, it's an hour and 40 minutes, and it's a slanging match, which is why I'm so hoarse. I know lots of actors who, if they're listening, will be saying, "She's got no technique, darling," but I don't have any technique. We just go for each other. But I my excuse is a slight throat infection as well.
Well, going for each other there were Tasmin Little and Richard Stutt playing the violins with the Bournemouth Sinfonietta, music from Tabula Rasa by Arvo Pärt. Did you sing when you were young?
Yes, I was introduced to choral singing. Again, my sister came home from school, is the legend, saying, "Oh, Dad, at school they're singing something called the Verdi Requiem. Shall I do it?" And this amazing boys' school up the road, UCS, University College School for Boys, had an amazing man called Colin Miles, who was the musical director, and he would put on, as many schools do, a fully orchestrated choral work once a year, and they invited the girls from the girls' school to come and provide some sop backup. And most of the girls did it because it would be your first opportunity to hang out with a boy. And by default, we became familiar with the most amazing pieces of classical music. And I thank Colin Miles for that here, and my father for saying, "Yes, you should go twice a week between 4 and 7 and sing these extraordinary pieces of music."
So you came to do Handel's Messiah, and I think you've chosen The Trumpet Shall Sound. And am I right in thinking there might be a not entirely altruistic reason behind this?
No, one of the other marvellous moments for bloke spotting were the orchestra they brought in on the night, and the trumpeter was the most beautiful young man. Whether he was fresh out of the army or still in the army, but he had a serious crew cut. And he stood up and played The Trumpet Shall Sound, and all of us fainted. It was, and I've never forgotten him. I don't know who he is and what he's doing now, but if in the early 80s you played the trumpet at University College School for Boys, I love you.
Shall sound, and the dead shall be raised, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible. The trumpet shall sound.
Trumpet Shall Sound from Handel's Messiah. David Thomas was the bass, and the Academy of Ancient Music was directed by Christopher Hogwood. The trumpeter, alas, Olivia Williams, was not, I think, your beau, but Michael Laird, who's a very fine trumpeter anyway.
I can see my beau in my mind's eye when he plays it, so that'll do for me.
It's a wonderful tune, but it also had that quality you were talking about earlier in the Bach of a kind of line that goes on unfolding.
Yeah, this music for me is sort of travelling music. you need to be on a country road with the roof down and driving. It's smiling, it's happy music, just as the tabula rasa I play when I need to weep. I play this if I need to smile.
And now another one that you also sang in, I think. Yes. Slightly less familiar than The Messiah, but still quite a famous piece.
Yes, I just love the overture of Elijah. I loved singing it, but in fact it was the instrumental bit at the beginning that captured it for me. I love this piece of music, and I don't know much else of Mendelssohn, so that's another reason to thank University College School for Boys Choral Society that it introduced me to music I wouldn't otherwise have heard.
First heard, funnily enough, in Birmingham.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Has to be the best entrance music of any pure theatre for me.
It rises up from nothing, doesn't it?
Mm.
And then you remember the moment when you had to stand
Yes, I remember, you know, sitting with my score open, watching Colin Miles with eager eyes for this signal to stand silently and start singing. It's very moving.
We heard The Overture to Elijah by Mendelssohn with the Edinburgh Festival Chorus, the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Paul Daniel. It must be interesting, Olivia Williams, when you've made a film, to see what difference, good or bad, the music makes when it's added.
I have been so lucky in my job because I have been able to befriend or just harass the composers that have worked on a couple of films and been allowed to watch the music being recorded. And what they do is they, in Hollywood, they have these vast studios and they put the movie up on a huge screen, like a cinema screen, and you have a 110-piece orchestra accompanying your performance live if you're there at the recording. And I've done it in LA and in London. There's an amazing studio up in Hampstead where I've seen a converted church with these, the very best musicians in the country playing original orchestral scores, accompanying some of my dodgier performances. And it's tremendously exciting. James Newton Howard allowed me in on The Postman and on The Sixth Sense to watch his extraordinary music being recorded. And it's one of the most thrilling experiences of my work.
In fact, I think it was your role as Mr. Cross in Rushmore that prompted this next choice.
Yes, it didn't end up in the film because Mark Mothersbaugh wrote original music, but very influenced by the Baroque. And I love it that he's so influenced by the music I love and the music that he eventually wrote. But there was an early cut of the film where they just put working music on it. And Miss Cross's theme was this next piece of music, which is from the Mandolin Concerto. The film is very modern and is set in modern times, and it's a cult film. It has all the predicaments of modern life, but this music just so perfectly depicts the loneliness and the solitariness of each of the characters, and even in their modern context. I love it.
There is something quite sort of isolated about that piece, isn't there? The mandolin is almost delicately plucking away, and the chords don't really support it very much.
I find that's true of almost all the slow movements of the mandolin concerti and the nature of the mandolin, which is not an, a sort of an attractive instrument on the whole, I don't find. But in these slow movements, the way the single plucked note rises above the orchestra, that's why I've chosen it, because it's absolutely position appropriate for this film, for its context, and I love it. I would never listen to a mandolin concerto under any other circumstances, I don't think.
We heard Paul Odet playing the mandolin with the Parley of Instruments directed by Roy Goodman. And that was the second movement, the Largo, of the Vivaldi Mandolin Concerto in C. The conductor of the next piece, which is in itself very dramatic, was somebody who brought a kind of theatre to his conducting, and really infectiously so, I think.
Yes, I love his work, both his composing work and his conducting. I had a collection of Bernstein conducts, and I love the energy he brings to everything from his own writing to Pachelbel's Canon is one of my very favourites, because he puts an energy into it that isn't always there. It's not too slow, it's not too self-indulgent, it's got this urgency.
And in Mahler, one sort of feels Bernstein kind of meets his nemesis, both in the pathos of the music and in the drama of it. You feel it relates to his personality so strongly.
Very much so, and I sort of feel caught up in the history of Mahler and Wagner with their sort of Nazi anti-Semitic connections, and the fact that Bernstein was Jewish. And part of what interests me and makes me love the Mahler and where it is in its history is, again, as it ran through my childhood, this juxtaposition of Judaism and fascism, and Wagner being the sort of the Nazis composer perceived in many ways, and Mahler being the man who converted to Christianity and was an integrated Jew who was thrown out and abused by the system. And those sort of waves, the effects of that, was still felt very strong as I was growing up. And I was introduced to this music by a Polish boyfriend I had, who had lived through the worst excesses of communism, or lack of excess, I don't know, the worst deprivations, I should say, worst privations of communism, and felt very keenly the pain of his country under Nazism. But he introduced me to this music, and it had a very profound effect on me at the time. I was in my early 20s when we were together.
And he went on to great things.
Yes. Well, he said when we were together he was going to re-enter Warsaw on a white charger and save it from communism. And that's pretty well what he did. He's made it to, I think he's foreign minister of Poland now.
Thank you. It manages to be both edgy and assertive, that music, doesn't it? Especially in that performance.
Yes, I love it that he's got, at the beginning, the nerve endings. It's almost like being at the dentist or something very medical when, you know, a doctor can actually pinpoint the nerve that makes your fingers twitch. And then I love that very ending, sort of the... It does sound like, you know, an army marching across countryside, a weary army. But what I love about this is it's foreground music. It's not something you can put on in the background at a dinner party. You know, this is demands your full attention and your full imagination.
That was the opening of the Symphony No. 2, The Resurrection by Mahler, and we heard the New York Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Leonard Bernstein. So did you actually play an instrument, Olivia Williams?
I did, yes. This bit of the programme's going to make my father and mother grip onto the furniture in pain because they had to listen to me practising the violin very badly. I think for about 8 years they had to put up with it. They brought me the violin. I said I wanted to play it, and I did. I took some grades, but I just could never make a decent sound out of it. But they would periodically produce a piece of great violin music for me to listen to sort of spur me on to greater things. And
to aspire to.
To aspire to, yes. And this was something for me to aspire to, which I never in any way even began to achieve.
You did, though, on the way. I mean, you did actually have some performing opportunities at a time when I think a much greater violinist, you won't mind my saying that, was struggling to make ends meet.
Yes, something that made my father laugh audibly and at the wrong moment in a theatre when he should have been being quiet and paying attention was the fact that I was playing many roles. One among the roles I played was a troll in Peer Gynt at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and this was a wonderful production with Alex Jennings playing Peer Gynt and John Barton, the great John Barton, directing. And he said at the beginning of the rehearsal period, something that makes every actor's heart sink, now, I think it'd be a wonderful idea if all the actors are on stage throughout the performance, which for Peer Gynt is, you know, 2.5 hours of being a troll and a villager and a camel and 400 other things. And we were each given had to play an instrument, and my troll, stupidly, I told them I could play the violin. I put my hand up. And John said, marvellous, 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 you're the violin playing troll. So for a year and a half, at a cost of about 30 quid a night, you could hear me play Norwegian folk songs on a violin very badly and very out of tune at a time when the great Cleo Gould, who was at school with me and a contemporary of mine, was struggling. She's a truly great violinist and was even at the age of 9. And, you know, she was struggling to fill a concert hall at that point. And this irony always made my father laugh. But he did. In the theatre, at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, he sat there and just giggled every time I picked the violin up.
Well, sadly, we've not got you playing the Brahms Violin Concerto, no. Although it may be a relief to your family to know that. We have got Fritz Kreisler. So we thought we might hear part of the recapitulation in the Kreisler cadenza.
Yes, it was very specific. When my father introduced me to this piece of music, he was very specific about it being the Kreisler cadenza that should be played. I can't remember why, but it's stuck in my head, and I only ever listen to the Kreisler cadenza when I'm listening to the Brahms Violin Concerto.
Thank you. That was the 1936 recording of the Brahms Violin Concerto in D, Opus 77, from which we heard the recapitulation, and for Olivia, the Kreisler cadenza.
Thank you.
With Fritz Kreisler playing the violin and the London Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Sir John Barbirolli. I suppose in many ways you've had moments of great luck and you've obviously enjoyed your life enormously, Olivia. But things sometimes turn on a sixpence, don't they? And I know you got a call from Kevin Costner, didn't you, which you were quite naughty about, and you could have blown it, couldn't you?
Well, I could have done. I don't think you can set out with the intention of being naughty or not meaning what you say when he...
This was for The Postman, wasn't
it? Yes, it was a film called The Postman, and I'd auditioned on video, which I was a tremendous sort of theatre snob at that stage, and the idea of auditioning on video was objectionable to me at the time, but I'd done it once. And when he asked me to do it a second time, I said no, and I sort of clutched my head in amazement now, but I did, because I thought that was right and proper at the time. And fortunately, the character he was looking to cast was extremely difficult and headstrong and bloody-minded, and my behaviour was perfect for the role. I have subsequently attempted this technique to get other jobs, and it hasn't worked, so I don't encourage young actors to refuse to audition on video.
I mean, these things, and then one thing leads to another, because then you were Bruce Willis's wife in Sixth Sense. So things just work out or they
don't. It is extraordinary. You cannot know where these roads will lead, and I love it.
Well, Olivia Williams, thank you very much for taking so joyously through these pieces of music that you love.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure, and it's made me realise I have to sort out my computer digital listening, because all the CDs, I had to root them out of the back of a garage, and it's made me dust them off and listen to them again. Thank you so much.
Olivia Williams was talking to Michael Barclay. Next Sunday, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the domestic historian Ruth Goodman, who's well known as one of the presenters of historical reality television shows such as Victorian and Edwardian Farm, Tales from the Green Valley and Victorian Pharmacy. Private Passions is a Classic Arts production for BBC Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall.
It's a totally different experience.
Totally unadulterated.
The excitement of it, the theatre of it.
People all over the UK are talking about it. A live concert every weekday night on BBC Radio 3.
This is a great step. The live broadcast is as close as it gets to the real thing.
Radio 3, live in concert.
You appreciate the musicians more, the conductor more.
Weeknights from 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And the first of those concerts is on Tuesday evening. It comes from Sherborne Abbey in Dorset. And in it, The 16, directed by Harry Christophers, will be performing music by Thomas Luis de Victoria. And the following evening, Wednesday, there's Wagner, the Overture to the Master Singers, Strauss's Four Last Songs, and Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony from the Royal Festival Hall in London. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online, just after 1 o'clock, and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. NATO has said it cannot confirm Libyan reports that Colonel Gaddafi's son and three of his grandchildren were killed in an airstrike on a villa in the capital Tripoli. The alliance said it was hitting the control and command infrastructure of the regime, in line with its United Nations mandate. Demonstrations are reported to have taken place outside British, American and Italian diplomatic buildings in Tripoli. The opposition in Yemen says it's considering escalating its campaign to force President Ali Abdullah Saleh from office because of his decision not to sign an agreement stipulating that he will resign. They've also refused to send a representative to talks today with the Gulf Cooperation Council, which drew up the deal. Head teachers have voted 99.6% in favour of balloting for strike action over planned changes to their pensions in England and Wales. The National Association of Head Teachers says its members could lose £100,000 on average when they retire. The schools minister, Nick Gibb, says rising costs and longer life expectancy means savings have to be made. David Cameron and Nick Clegg have both insisted that the referendum on changing the voting system for Westminster elections will not split the coalition, regardless of who wins. Mr Cameron said the coalition would keep its focus despite recent disagreements. Mr Clegg said it would work in the national interest. Police in the Maldives have used tear gas and batons to break up a protest calling for the resignation of President Mohamed Nasheed. The opposition say they were protesting against what they call the government's inaction on rising unemployment and the rising cost of living. Pope Benedict has beatified his predecessor John Paul II in front of more than a million pilgrims in St Peter's Square. A senior Vatican cardinal said the late Pope had not been aware of the extent of the child abuse scandal which emerged in the final years of his pontificate. And the weather, most parts will be dry and sunny, although there'll be gusty easterly winds, gusty over the hills. We've already been told it's gusty, now it's gusty again, particularly the Pennines. Some heavy and thundery showers will develop in southern counties of England and Wales. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one. And it's time now for the early music show. And picking up on yesterday's programme, in which the subject was royal weddings, unsurprisingly, Catherine Bott reflects on a highlight from last year's York Early Music Festival.
Wedding ceremonies have always been occasions for music, and today's concert, given by Musica Fiata and La Cappella Ducale, is called Wedding Motets and Songs of Love. Their chosen repertoire has its roots in adversity. During the 30 Years' War, which lasted from 1618 to 1648, German composers, even the great trio of Heinrich Schütz, Johann Hermann Schein and Samuel Scheidt, seldom had the opportunity to publish their works. But society weddings, with money no object, gave them the chance to have their music performed and appreciated by the great and the good, and most importantly, rich patrons were happy to pay for the printing of the scores. So everybody won. The happy couple enjoyed the music, their wealthy families demonstrated their cultural credibility, and composers got their works printed. Now, two caveats before we go on. These pieces weren't always specially written for the occasion. A grand wedding could serve as a good excuse to get an existing work performed, perhaps with a hastily added nuptially appropriate title. And I think we should have a little more than the usual passing reference to the depredations of the 30 Years' War. But first, let's hear some music. A piece with a very definite wedding theme. Musica Fiata and La Cappella Ducale perform Scheidt's Freue dich des Weibes deiner Jugend. Rejoice in the wife of your youth.